Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. On the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name. The echo is haunting. The echo is always the same. I call your name. The echo is haunting. An echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg. Thank you for joining us tonight. I should mention that our guest tonight, Dr. Parisetti, is joining us from Scotland. So in order to enable Piero to get some sleep, we're doing this as a pre-record, which means, unfortunately, we won't be taking any listener call-ins. I don't have many other announcements other than the fact that Dr. Parisetti will be doing a webinar for the foundation on September 18th, the basis for a rational belief in life after death. And you can find and register for that webinar on our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Let me go right in and introduce my friend and our guest tonight. Piero Calvi Parisetti is a medical doctor, author, scholar, and lecturer. He originally specialized in public health and disaster management and was employed by the International Red Cross and the United Nations. He worked there for about a decade in the management of large-scale humanitarian aid operations in Africa, Asia, and the former Soviet Union. At the end of the year 2000, he moved from the field operations to the classroom, and he took up a late academic career. He then developed a scholarly passion for psychical research, especially for the study of empirical and scientific evidence pointing to the survival of human personality of bodily death. And after digesting some 30,000 pages of literature, in 2008, Dr. Parisetti wrote his first book, 21 Days into the Afterlife. His other books are Apparitions, Proof of Survival, Adventures in Psychical Research, A Medical Doctor's Exploration of the Nature of Consciousness and Its Survival to Bodily Death, a book, Dear to Our Hearts, Love Knows No Death, which is an interactive workbook directed to those who suffer because of the loss of a loved one and those who are in fear of their own impending death. I should mention this approach aims to help the bereaved and the dying develop a rational belief in life after life. And that belief is based on reason and built upon the critical of evaluation of evidence rather than on faith. Dr. Parisetti is a member of Forever Family Foundation Scientific Advisory Board. And I should mention that he donated this workbook that I mentioned, Love Knows No Death, to Forever Family Foundation. And for that, we are forever grateful. His latest book, which we're going to talk about tonight, is Step into the Light, Transform Your Fear of Death by Learning About Life After Life. The website is drparisetti.com, which is drparisetti.com. Well, welcome, my friend. Welcome to the show.
My dear Bob, you don't know what pleasure it is for me to talk to you. It's bizarre too. It's not the first time we do this, but it always feels a little strange to do an interview with one of your dearest personal friends, literally. Bob Ginsberg, let everybody know, is one of the dearest persons I have on earth. It's a joy to talk to him privately and also publicly with an audience.
Well, I echo your sentiments towards you. I do consider you a dear friend, and maybe even more importantly, we admire the work that you've done in helping the bereaved. So let's get right into it. I mean, I mentioned your new book, Step into the Light. In the book, you refer to evidence that points to survival of consciousness after bodily death as the unbelievable truth. So what do you mean when you talk about unbelievable truth?
Let me give you the rundown, you and your listeners, because some of our friends might have heard me before, but some others perhaps not. So very briefly, let me recap my story, in a way, the evolution that I went through in the last 20 years, essentially. And, you know, I like to remind people that I am a Western-educated medical doctor. That is, I am the product of a system of belief that maintains that anything that can possibly exist is matter. If you cannot touch it, if you cannot, you know, measure it with instruments or other ways, it simply does not exist. And I was very happy. I grew up with that at school, and then, you know, I went to uni, and then apart from my medical studies, I had an interest in physics, and so I was very happy with that worldview. And I thought it served me well. And I always want to tell this little story because it's cute, and it was really a turning point in my life. And I was living in Geneva in Switzerland at the time, and together with my wife. And one day over tea in the kitchen, as one does, she told me a little spooky story that happened to her when she was an adolescent, late adolescent, I would say, was a young woman. In our native Glasgow, and it's a story, Bob, that I always say, if you or anybody else had told me that story at that time, I would have smiled politely and moved on, you know, shrugged it off. It's a cute story. It's a story of wrappings and you know. But I could tell after all these years that my wife, who's the person I know best and I trust the most, she was still perturbed by this. And so with a stiff upper lip attitude that I had back then, I said, let me see if anything serious has been written on all this, you know, whatever. And I immediately stumbled upon a book that was really to change my life, written by the late Professor David Fontana, who was a super credentialed academic psychologist, member of the Royal Society. Doesn't get any more prestigious than that here in the UK. And the book, 575 pages, was called Is There an Afterlife? ? A Review of the Evidence. So I bought it. And that changed my life. That was my, you know, St. Paul on the way to Damascus moment, or almost. And as I did not become a convert instantly, you know, it's been a long process. And I think we've all, in our own way, everybody who studied evidence for the afterlife has had to struggle with this. And that's, I'm here, I took a long way home, but now I'm reconnecting to your initial question, why do you call this incredible? Because old habits die hard. And I mean, our senses and our everyday experience, which is very strong, you know, tell us that the world is matter, and when we die, we die. End of story. One moment you're alive, the next moment, lights off, you're gone. And so having to, you know, confront this incredible amount of evidence coming, as I say, as he used to say, from about 12 different independent fields of investigation. Evidence that's been, you know, gathered and studied by some of the most brilliant minds on the planet for the last 150 years, including, I always say, as many as 5 Nobel Prize winners. And so at the end of an arduous intellectual path, you know, as you said in your kind introduction, I read a lot. I became member of the Society for Psychical Research in the UK, the International Association for Near-Death Studies in the US. I went to conferences, I went to study days, I even trained personally with somebody your listeners will know very well, Dr. Raymond Moody, who was the first one to write about near-death experiences in the early 70s. And so at the end of this long and I wouldn't say painful, but it was challenging, intellectually challenging process. Today, my incredible truth is as follows. Number one, what we call mind cannot be reduced to the functioning of the physical brain. So mind does not equal brain. They're very closely related, obviously, but mind is, there's no two ways, is more than the physical brain. And number two, going back to your question, in a way which we do not understand, human personalities survive physical deaths. I don't claim to have an explanation. I think that anybody who does lies, but that's my own person. It's a gigantic mystery. It's very, very difficult to wrap our arms around that, but the evidence doesn't lie. Anybody who's considered the evidence, the facts, empirical evidence, we're talking about facts, all right? Anybody who studied the evidence with the care it deserves and is intellectually honest is obliged to take this, you know, quite momentous conclusion. I repeat, in a way we do not understand, or at least we do not yet understand, and we don't die. We survive physical death. And that's my bottom line. Over to you, Bob.
Okay. Well, you know, in all of your books, including, you know, Step Into the Light, you always, you encourage people to use their rational minds. I mean, if you, especially when contemplating the possibility of life after death. So I take it that you believe that if you have a foundation for belief that's based on evidence, that's more powerful than having a blind faith that's possibly fostered by, you know, religion or cultural norms.
Absolutely. And this is not something, it's not only, at least, something that I like to believe because I like the idea, but it's something that is heavily supported, again, by evidence, by research. If you look at the discipline of cognitive behavior, psychotherapy, particularly cognitive psychotherapy, that is the therapy of choice, the first line therapy, and often the last because it's so effective for anxiety disorders and particularly depression. And cognitive therapy is about restructuring wrong thoughts. Essentially, cognitive therapy teaches you to think less negatively because depressed people engage in habits of thoughts which are excessively negative. And so cognitive therapy does not aim to replace one belief, the world is horrible, with another belief, the world is fantastic, because that has been tried and positive psychology, unfortunately, does not work. Cognitive psychology teaches people to think less negatively, more rationally, in a more balanced way, which fits more with the facts. And that's exactly the attitude I take to survival of death. So that's one in a way, a supporting pillar to my approach. The other supporting pillar is very, very interesting. And it shows in practice, really, how changing the way you think changes a lot of things in a way you know, in your psychology and in your behaviors. Let me briefly tell you this story because it really is fascinating. And we're looking at Dr. Kenneth Ring, who's one of the foremost scholars and researchers on near-death experiences. And if I'm not mistaken, in the late 80s, he carried out a very interesting study. Anybody who studied NDEs, near-death experiences, know that the people who've had one undergo a number of psychological and behavioral changes which are highly beneficial. They all become less materialistic and more interested in knowledge for its own sake, more altruistic. If they were narrowly religious, they developed a much broader idea of spirituality. And what is very important, their fear of death is erased completely and forever because they've been there. These people have died and have seen in their own first-hand experience what lies afterwards. And so they've got no fear of death anymore. But there's that, and there are another. Now, I mean, the list is long, but I mean, they become better people, right?
Mm.
Now, what Kenneth Ring showed is that the same beneficial changes appear in persons who have not had an NDE, but simply read about NDE research. And the more they read, the more they learned, the more they engaged with the near-death experience evidence, the more these beneficial changes appeared. And so I am convinced, and the users of my the manual that we've been working together with the foundation and the video course that associated with that, I mean, the users tell that I would say on an average month, I receive 3 or 4 emails with people telling me that has really helped me. And that's great. It means that it is an approach when you change your thinking about death, and particularly the death of a loved one, your quality of life improves.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about, you know, this book, the latest book, Step Into the Light, is a little bit different in your approach than some of the others, because you gear this book towards alleviating the fear that people have about death, and reducing the fear of death, I mean, also translates into the grieving process. I mean, one is not exclusive of the other. True. I mean, it's not only are you looking to alleviate the fears that people have, but that in and of itself will help you if you're grieving the loss of a loved one.
Most definitely, Bob. And this was an unintended side benefit, if you want. I did write it, and I'll give a little background in a second. But then again, through this marvelous system we have today, I mean, the world we live in, which has many woes but also has as many advantages, the ease of being in touch for an author, for a public person, with his or her public is fantastic. So people buy my book and they write me an email, and I love that, absolutely. And anybody in amongst the listeners now who would like to connect with me, go onto my website, drparizetti.com. Plenty of free stuff there. There's an entire book for free. Apparitions is for free. There are articles for free. There are links to my books. And there's a link to me. So do write to me. I love that. And people tell me, people who have bought Step Into the Light found it useful in their grieving process, although the book was written for those in fear of death. Let me very quickly recap. Again, a little bit of background and history here. Something I'm always keen to do is to dust off a little bit a term that we've not been using anymore. Essentially, I don't think in particularly in the North American environment, the term psychical research means anything anymore. In the UK, it does for those in our circles, particularly because of the Society for Psychical Research, but it's something that has really gone out of fashion. And psychical research is very simple, because it's the mashing up of what we call today parapsychology, that is the study of as yet unexplained human powers like telepathy, clairvoyance, distant, you know, precognition, psychokinesis, and all that, together with the study of evidence for life after life, evidence for survival of personality of bodily death. The two together form applied psychical research. And as I was studying and going through the process you yourself have gone through, reading all that's available, devouring, you know, reports and books and everything, very early on, I realized that this could have been of great use to these two categories of people, the bereaved and the dying, or broadly speaking, those in fear of death. Because the message of survival is a great message of hope. And I realized this very soon. And as a medical doctor and as a former humanitarian, my primary instinct, really a very basic instinct, is to be of help. I want to try to prevent suffering in other people. And what better way of doing this than through disseminating, explaining, and sharing what I was learning. And, you know, I've been a university lecturer for 17 years, and I know I'm good at that. I'm sorry to be a little bit, you know, big-headed, but I know I'm good at explaining things. I love it, and I'm good at it. And so, my area of specialty became applied psychical research. That is the use of the findings of what today we call afterlife science, and that's parlance of our beloved foundation, and we refer to it as afterlife science. So using the findings of this for a practical purpose, and me being a doctor, I want to not cure, but help people, relieve people of their pain and their fear.
And you know, you made a very interesting point to show why things such as telepathy and clairvoyance and so forth are part of a belief in an afterlife. Because if you don't believe in telepathy, it's illogical to assume that we survive our physical deaths, because you're succumbing to the mainstream notion that who we are is contained within our skulls. But things like telepathy that show that our minds or our consciousness can extend beyond our bodies is a prerequisite to a belief in an afterlife, correct?
Absolutely. That's been one of my battle horses. Yeah. However, Bob, I need to very friendlily correct you. Telepathy doesn't need belief. We don't believe in the laws of gravity. The laws of gravity are the best explanation we have at the moment for how the world works in that sector, or, you know, the theory of relativity, or I don't know, whatever area of science. So we don't need to believe in parapsychology and the human faculties. They have been shown to exist by the standards applied to any other area of science. So we surrender. Because it is a surrender, because we don't really think it is possible. Well, we never thought that the distortion of the space-time continuum described by Einstein was possible. Well, it bloody well is. You see what I mean? So even things that appear incredible on the surface appear incredible to our everyday common sense and physical senses. When looked at through the lens of science, they become credible, because that's how the world works. And I mean, thousands upon thousands of papers published in peer-reviewed journals over 100 years, amounting to tens of millions individual trials, attest to the fact that humans have these powers. If humans have these powers, as you very correctly said, that's incompatible. That it means that it's incompatible with mind equals brain paradigm, and indicates, as we said in the beginning, and it just repeated, that mind is more than the brain. And that opens indeed the door. It makes accepting the idea of an afterlife more palatable, more, you know, approachable. And I would not, how could I say, it's here I'm venturing on a territory that I'm not entirely sure of, because I consider these unexplained human powers proven over and out. Is the afterlife proven? Yes, for me, yes, indeed. But it's proven not according to the same standards, but the same methods that we use in other areas of science. Here, in the case of the afterlife, it is the collective weight of a stupendous amount of evidence, mostly facts. And again, I invite those who are interested in that, in this area, and want to engage the rational mind to join in for the webinar in September, because there I will share my views about to what consists, what evidence consists of. What do we call evidence? And we see that there's three categories and blah, blah. I don't want to preempt anything, but I mean, we have to find a way to seep through these incredible masses of evidence we have for the afterlife. And it's evidence that comes from very diverse fields. We move from, yes, parapsychology, as we said, to deathbed visions, to reincarnation studies, near-death experiences, and many different forms of after-death communication, in which they're so diverse that in themselves they create an independent area of evidence in my analysis. And the beauty of it is that it is not only enormous in quantity, it is also consistent. Everything points to the same idea, i.e. that we survive physical death. So the amount, in many cases, the quality of the evidence we have and its internal consistency is what convinces a rational mind that we do not die.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And one of the values of learning about all the various and diverse areas of research and evidence is that you reach a point, which I certainly did in my life. I mean, I tended to try to dismiss, one area of research, but eventually you have to succumb to the weight of the collective evidence. You know, you might be able to dismiss mediumship, or you may try to dismiss near-death experiences, dismiss end-of-life experiences, or reincarnation, or electronic voice phenomena. You know, but when you step back and you look at it as a whole, you have to relent at some point. At least I did. You know, one thing I wanted to mention is that, and again, I could relate to this in my personal search. When I started to contemplate life after death, after, you know, suffering loss of a loved one, I started to read, before I read books like you mentioned in David Fontana's book, Is There an Afterlife? One of the first books that I read was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I also read, you know, a bunch of, Buddhist philosophy. And I didn't find it comforting for me, because the notion that when we die, you know, we get absorbed into a cosmic soup and lose all memories and personality, I found troubling. It was, you know, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. So what is some of the evidence that tells us that we don't lose all memory and personality?
Wow. Interestingly enough, but here we're taking a very, very big leap into the last chapter of Step Into the Life. Eventually, what our Buddhist friends, and as I say this, I'm looking at a beautiful bust of a Buddha, a head of a Buddha I brought back from Tibet, whose veils upon me from one of the shelves, and I bow in respect. But what in something that might have been lost in translation or whatever in the Buddhist doctrine is that eventually we will indeed be reabsorbed in the ground of being, which is indeed consciousness. But in doing so, even then, we will not lose our individuality. And this is extraordinary. And it's another big mystery, but we've been told so in no uncertain terms. And we will come in a moment to the book and the sources, because I mean, I'd like to talk about it, because it's it was a cute idea. Like in 21 days, the cute idea to use a dialogue between myself and a skeptic, and going over 21 days of dialogue, and each day we look at a different area of evidence. Here in Step Into the Light, I have taken a different approach. Are you I don't understand. I don't. Sorry. I don't think that in North America you're familiar with the Lonely Planet guides. Are you? Does this say anything to you?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Lonely Planet is a beautiful, it's a brilliant idea that's been around for decades now. And the idea is that a backpacker goes to Thailand. They do their travel for 6 months. And every month or so, they send back a report to the host about the hostels they visited, the restaurants they visited, and blah, blah, about the experience. At the same time, a couple of middle-aged tourists well off go to Thailand, spend 2 weeks in that resort and blah, blah, and they send back a little report. And Lonely Planet, which is, if I'm not mistaken, is based in the Netherlands, has been collecting these reports for decades, editing them, putting them together, and publishing guides. In this case, a guide to Thailand, but Lonely Planet guides exist for most tourist destinations in the world. And they're beautiful because they're produced by people who have been there. You hear it from the horse's mouth directly, okay? And so the guides, every year or two, they get republished with new information. The old one disappears and the new one comes in. It's a beautiful idea. So essentially, what I thought of doing was to put together a Lonely Planet guide to the afterlife. With the intention and with the aim of relieving some of the fear and the worries, or maybe the simple curiosity people have around the process of death, the process of dying, and what happens afterwards. And so I looked at, you know, what the collective, you know, the masses of what I have learned, and I could identify, we all could identify easily three classes of travelers we want to hear from. And these travelers, or these sources, let's call them, have had a direct experience of, as I say, the process of dying and what comes afterwards. And these sources are deathbed vision experiences, near-death experiences, and after-death communication. So we've got people who are approaching death and have a glimpse, at times even a long and very complex glimpse of what awaits them. And then we have people who essentially die. You know, we know that near-death experiences are best known in the case of cardiac arrest, but not because it's the most frequent cause. Is that, well, there are technical reasons why they're better studied. But NDEs happen in a number of circumstances by which the brain essentially is not there anymore. We don't want to talk about that now. Take my word. You go to my website. There's a technical article explaining why NDEs are NDEs. They're not, I mean, it demolishes all the explanations that have been put forward during the years, and therefore prove to be, I'm getting confused here because I want to say too much. I'll stop myself here because I wanted to go back to something you just said before. I will not. So deathbed visions as a source of information on what happens before we die. Near-death experiences and spirit communicators as a source of information on what happens afterwards. However, here we are again. We have plenty of testimony from these sources. Written testimony, and in case of spirit communicators, going up well over a century, I would say over a century and a half. In the case of NDEs, well, NDEs have been documented 25 centuries ago and described exactly in the same terms and words as we do today. But still, testimony about NDEs is something of the last 50 years, and we have plenty of that. And then we've got end-of-life experiences, deathbed visions. And there too, we have tons of accounts. What do we do, Bob? Do we take these accounts at face value? It's beautiful because they are really fantastic. They are really hope-inspiring. But that's not my attitude. That's not my way of operating. My intellectual honesty obliges me to show, to demonstrate to my readers, to my public, why these sources are worth believing, and why it is reasonable to trust these sources. So the first part of the book is a little bit of a CSI detective, you know, a scientific detective investigation. We look at these three phenomena in different chapters. We describe them. We dissect them. And particularly, as I said for NDE, we look at all possible alternative explanation in detail, because I want to engage the rational mind of my readers. At the end of that detective work, I want my readers to be personally convinced that these sources are who or what they claim to be. That is, personalities who've had either a glimpse of the afterlife or are in the afterlife and are communicating with us through mediums and many other means. Once we have established the credibility of this of these sources, then we engage in a detailed step-by-step description of what happens. And we do this extensively quoting these sources. It's not only the second half of the book, it's not just quotes. There's quite a bit from me to frame these quotes, to, you know, to organize them and to make reading more, because otherwise it soon becomes boring. And I want the reader to remain engaged. Yeah. And on your go, please.
Yeah, you may be thinking, you know, in that, you know, the last part of the book, which differs from, you know, some of your other writings, so you get more into what people, after all, one of the most commonly asked questions is, you know, we believe that you survive your physical death, but what happens? What's the afterlife like? You know, what's the meaning and purpose of a physical existence? And you write that there's no fundamental difference, you know, between the material and the non-material worlds. It's just a matter of levels or dimensions or external appearance. And at all levels, we exist to have experiences. So when a lot of people, they question, well, why do we need a physical world? You know, if there's growth and there's room for advancement and enlightenment, you know, in the afterlife, you know, why do we have to go through this physical experience? So I guess my question is, do you think that we have experiences here in the physical world that we can't have elsewhere or in other dimensions or realms?
Absolutely. And again, I feel slightly uncomfortable because you asked the question to me as if I was some sort of guru with knowledge imparted by some other thing. It's not me.
You're not Pete.
Okay, I'm speaking on behalf of these sources, all right? I mean, that's what they say. Okay. People who have gone through the process, that's what they say. And therefore, I grew convinced myself. And interesting, I've just received a letter of all things. A guy who's here in Britain who's read the book and said, you know, so I'm an old-fashioned person, I want to write you a letter. What's your address? I gave him address, and he sent me a letter. And in the letter, he basically rewrote my book, essentially, because he himself has gone through tons of literature, and he restates the conclusions that I make in the book exactly. So it's interesting that it's not only it's not me speaking, but my interpretation of what the sources are saying, it seems to be the same. And Professor David Fontana hinted into the same direction, and others like Michael Timm who have written on the subject that we all seem to agree on what the sources say. And what the sources say on this particular issue is exactly how you framed it. A, we exist to have experiences. I can expand to that, but maybe later. B, certain experiences can only be had on the physical plane, be it on Earth or maybe other planets in the universe, we don't know, probably. And a part of the learning that we have to do as souls, and please appreciate that I use the term soul in a non-religious manner. For ease, is a shorthand for whatever is it that goes through, you know, incarnations and then periods in the various levels of the afterlife, because we have detailed descriptions of the fact that our life in the non-material world happens on different plans and different environments, which are all spiritual, non-material, but have different levels of spirituality. There too, there is an ascension, there is a growing. So certain experiences can be only had in the physical world, others can only be had in the non-physical world. And I don't know if you want me already to paint the grand scheme that emerges when you look at all these testimonies from a distance. It turns out, wait, let me see that, not because I really, maybe just a few of the listeners will go on and buy the book, but I want to disseminate a few of the key messages, because they are so beautiful, they are so hope-inspiring, that I think they really are worth sharing and disseminating. Number one beautiful truth is that contrary to what we believe, we don't die. But that's the underlying incredible truth. Now, in detail, contrary to what many people fear, we do not die alone. Okay, evidence from deathbed visions is unequivocal on that. We die, most of us die accompanied, welcomed, received by deceased loved ones, and short of that, by spiritual beings, more evolved souls who come across in the very latest stages of experience, very often come across and help people making the transition. So A, we don't die alone. Second beautiful truth is that the moment of death, which is feared by many as a terrible experience, it is a non-experience. Bob, there is no interruption in the flow of consciousness. The Le vécu, comme on dit en français, sorry for the French, but the life experience immediately before and immediately after the cessation of the functions of the body is exactly the same. There is no difference. If there is a difference, that happens in the cases when the person had a difficult death. You know, the person was in pain or in grave discomfort, difficult breathing or whatever in the lead up to the moment of death. Well, the signal that death has come, that death has happened, is that all that suffering goes away. And people say, what the heck's happening? It's still me, it's me, it's exactly me as a second ago, but all that pain has gone away, has lifted. And this is extraordinary. So the death from as I say, the personal experience point of view is a non-event, the moment of transition. And then, as I said, what happens afterwards varies to some extent. from one person to the next. And I don't have time, we don't have time now to dig into the details of this, but increasingly, I mean, let's say that the spirit world appears organized in, as I said, in different levels. The initial stages, which I like to call lower levels, but I mean lower not because they're inferior, but lower because, I mean, we like to think of higher levels as you ascend to more spiritual, less material, more ethereal dimensions of being. So the immediate afterlife is very close to the material world, to the point that the surroundings are exactly the same and people see their own body and they're a little shocked at the appearance of their body lying on a bed whilst they feel perfectly alive and well. And many people go to their own funeral and are distraught at the you know, suffering, seeing the suffering of their loved ones. And so there's an initial period which is very similar and very close to the earthly plane. Then some, but not all, go through a period which is described as essentially sleep, resting. And upon waking, there's this, the third beautiful truth, which has to do with the life review process, which is very well described by near-death experiences and described essentially in the same terms, with the same words, the same kind of images, but those who've actually died. And the life review is a process in which one relives every single instant of their past life, the earthly life. They rethink every thought, they rethink every, they refill every emotion, and crucially, they are made aware of, in a first person lived experience, they're made aware of the impact of their actions on others. So the beautiful truth is that there is no judgment, there's no punishment, there's no heaven on or earth. There is a life review process where the person himself or herself is the judge. And this process has only one goal, which is learning, maturing, growing, understanding the experiences had in a material world. And then by an organic, inevitable process of soaring, of expanding, souls go on to what I call, for again shorthand, the first heaven, and then a second heaven. Very, very nice places, very interesting places, which are very well described by our spirit communicators. And I liken the process to a bubble of, a tiny bubble of water at the bottom of the ocean. And the bubble cannot do anything but soaring and going upwards. And as it goes upwards, it expands and becomes less dense, and then it expands. There's nothing, it cannot be avoided, is a natural process of soaring and ascending. And this, even you know, the first and second heavens, which are very pleasurable, very interesting places, our communicator friends tell us that at some stage you grow tired of that and you feel pulled, magnetically attracted towards more light, more warmth, more love, and towards the higher dimensions of the spirit world. However, final, maybe second last good message, good news is that at that stage, most of people, through a process which is a little complicated, we cannot describe now, but choose another incarnation and they start the process again. So life, as I say, as you pointed out briefly and kindly, as I described in the last chapter, life appears, as I said, as a huge, grand, magnificent scheme made of many, many, many sequences of earthly incarnation followed by a sojourn in the various stages of the afterlife. But this is not a circle, because a circle only exists in a plan. A circle, you would go around in circle. In this case, you're on a spiral, because this circle goes up and up and up. And every iteration of this process, you learn more, you become wiser, you become more refined, and so you have, quote unquote, better earthly incarnations and better experiences in the afterlife. And this somehow, again, has been, in my very respectful opinion, poorly translated by the concept of karma. It's not that. Never mind. Let's not get confused. And final big truth. At the end of this long, grand, gigantic process, we do not reincarnate anymore. We do merge back into the ground of being. People of faith may call this God. I'd rather call it cosmic consciousness or basic consciousness, that ocean of awareness that generated us in the first, in the beginning, and now reabsorbs us. But there too, as I said in the beginning, we do not lose our individuality. I'm sorry, Bob. I've spoken for, I think, 25 minutes, but I wanted to put these messages across.
Well, it's very important, you know, and a lot of things that people ask, I'm sure they ask you, I know it comes up to us a lot, is, you know, people worry or are curious about, you know, what about people that live this physical life in a less than compassionate and loving manner? You know, I mean, some might call them evil, you know. You know, do they go to the same place? And I think that based upon the evidence and in fitting with what you just described, we kind of gravitate to be among people who thought and acted the way that we thought while we were in the physical. But that doesn't mean that they are, for lack of a better term, you know, condemned or jailed in a specific sphere with no opportunities for growth. Even the worst among us are part of this progression of moving towards the light, you know, and based upon self-judgment, that they're exactly where they need to be, at least initially. Does that make sense?
I could not have put it any better, Bob. First of all, people who are having what we consider, you say, you're very, very compassionately say less than good, I would say outright bad. Existences may be harming others and everything. They are young souls, we are told. We were there at some stage ourselves, Bob. We all have to be compassionate towards them because they're at the beginning of the process. And part of the process, unfortunately, is having these bad lives, bad for themselves, bad for others. And that, again, is for the grand purpose of experiencing. When they move into the, not only them, all of us, when we move into the non-physical realms, we find ourselves in the place that we have prepared with our earthly life, our most recent earthly life, okay? We gravitate towards, as you say, towards people who have the same, towards souls who have the same worldview and levels, and we keep engaging, at least in the first and second heaven. Listen how assuredly I speak about these incredible things. I know it sounds, I hear myself talking, and it's really a little bizarre. But that's what, as those who will have the kindness of you know, reading the book will see. I mean, we've been told so very clearly by the spirit communicators. And so you and I, who are relatively decent people, will end up, Bob, in very, very beautiful, very attractive, as I say, very interesting and very attractive first and second heavens. People who've had difficult lives, difficult for themselves and others, will not have this the same kind of nice surroundings and nice experiences.
Right.
However, the bubble image is true for us and it's true for them. We will not stop in paradise, so to speak, and they will not stop in less than paradise. There's no hell. The thing about the harrowing near-death experiences and the parts of the early afterlife, which sometimes are described as bleak, miserable, outright unpleasant. But that's not hell, and in any case, it's not forever, because we can't but grow. We can't but soar, lift, and expand. So nothing is forever. Paradise is forever. Is not forever. Less than paradise is not forever.
And I know we're reaching the end of our time. I think the important take-home message here, and I don't say this from a religious perspective, but more of a spiritual perspective, is the likelihood is that the way in which we conduct our lives while here temporarily in the physical world may very well affect our progression once we go enter the non-physical world. So, I mean, that's what I make out of it. Completely. We have been talking with Dr. Piero Calvi Parisetti. The book, which is a must read, is Step Into the Light, Transform Your Fear of Death by Learning About Life After Life. The website is Dr. Parisetti, PARISETTI.com. We could talk to Pete for a week on this subject and still only scratch the surface. So we'll just have to keep inviting him back. I know we're trying to talk him into coming to one of our grief retreats in the United States in 2022. Who knows?
Which maybe will happen for sure. Yeah. I already very much look forward to.
Okay. And we look forward to that, and maybe, who knows, maybe we'll be able to do something more in his neck of the woods. So, my good friend, thank you so much for joining us and for continuing to help so many people. We look forward to seeing you and speaking with you more. We look forward to your webinar on September 18th, and again, you can check out the details on that webinar on foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Have a good night, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Bob. And let me say very briefly that you're in the dual position of a host of this kind of show and an author yourself. So you can appreciate this very well. We as authors would not exist. Our job would be meaningless if we did not have channels to reach a potential audience. And therefore, hosts of the shows and radios and podcasts and whatever are as important. We produce information, but the channels to disseminate that information are as important and as good. So it's me to thank you, and again, the Forever Family Foundation, which is a very, very dear organization to me.
Thank you so much, and good night, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.